with winds gusting up to 135 kilometers per hour, Cyclone Raymal makes landfall.
Bangladesh raised its storm danger signal to its highest level of 10 for two ports and nine coastal districts.
Georgia celebrates Independence Day, but with the Russian threat hanging over its head.
The Georgians are very afraid that they're having kind of a Ukrainian scenario, which is a creeping introduction of more and more influence in the Kremlin.
And another turbulence incident on a jetliner, 12 injured. Is climate change making turbulence worse?
Severe turbulence has increased by 55%.
Today is Monday, May 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Cyclone Raymal made landfall between the coasts of Bangladesh and India, bringing heavy rains that flooded homes and farmland and left a trail of destruction. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino says nearly 800,000 people were evacuated in preparation for the storm, the first cyclone of the year.
Bangladesh raised its storm danger signal to its highest level of 10 for two ports and nine coastal districts. The country's chief of disaster management told Reuters that tens of thousands of people have been moved to shelters. India deployed its disaster relief force in the eastern state of West Bengal, and flights at Kolkata's airport were canceled. The Indian Navy said it is keeping ships, aircraft, divers, and medical supplies on standby for deployment, if required. The low-lying coasts of Bangladesh and India have experienced frequent severe storms in recent years, including Cyclone Yaas in 2021, which left more than 50,000 people homeless. The severe weather in the east comes as western India swelters under a deadly heat wave. Temperatures of nearly 113 degrees Fahrenheit were recorded in parts of the country, which is in the midst of the world's largest election.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino. Flooding caused by heavy rain and rivers bursting their banks in Armenia and Georgia has left one person dead, villages cut off, hundreds of people being evacuated from their homes. She says near this building, there was a huge shed for the livestock. Her animals were in there, chickens and pigs. She only managed to save her dog. Radio Free Europe reported that the Debed River had burst its banks, blocking a highway and a railway link between Armenia and Georgia. Georgia's Interpress news agency reported that at least 15 villages were cut off from the outside world. Georgia on Sunday held celebrations in Tbilisi's Freedom Square to mark its Independence Day. Georgia's president saying today, as the specter of Russia looms over us, partnership with Europe is the true path to preserving and strengthening our independence and peace. And there were more protests in Georgia over what is being called the Russia law, which it's feared will erode freedom in the country. In Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky appealed to U.S. President Joe Biden and Chinese leader Xi Jinping on Sunday to join an upcoming peace summit as his country struggles to stave off unrelenting attacks by Russia.
We all know who are we dealing with. Russia is run by men who want to make it a norm, burning lives, destroying cities and villages, dividing people and erasing national borders through war. There is no nation that can stop such war alone. Unaided world leaders' engagement is needed.
In an English language video recorded inside the charred remains of a printing press destroyed on Thursday in a Russian airstrike, Zelensky said the summit would show who in the world really wants to end the war. So let's talk about this, the Russian threat in Ukraine, in Georgia, and in other nations in the region. Joining us now is Bronislav Slonchev from the University of California, San Diego. He studies military coercion, interwar negotiations, the conduct of war, and war termination in the Department of Political Science. So let's talk about Georgia first. You know, it's Independence Day, and yet the president is talking about the Russian threat, and people are in the streets protesting this new law, which they call the Russian law.
So very quickly, the reason they're calling it the Russian law is because it's modeled after, it's patterned after a law that Putin and, you know, had passed in Russia many years ago, that they then used to clamp down basically on the freedom of press. And so they see this as the first step toward kind of curtailing their freedoms. And so that's part of the reason that people are so vehement about it. Like, on its surface, it doesn't sound like a big deal, like wanting NGOs to register their income, where they come from. I mean, we ask the NGOs here to register about things like this. But the problem is that people can see very clearly what's going to happen next, right? And so the Georgians are very afraid that they're having kind of a Ukrainian scenario, which is a creeping introduction of more and more influence in the Kremlin. So even though the president is very pro-Western, she's not really, you know, powerful under the Georgian constitution. It's a parliamentary republic. And so it's the party in the prime minister. And these are known to be very pro-Russian. And so they're doing this. They already used force to suppress some of the demonstrations. They're, I think, very careful not to go as far as the pro-Russian government did in Ukraine, that eventually provoked widespread resistance with Maidan, right, and led to the fall of the government. So they're a little bit more careful. But it seems to be a similar scenario that's playing out. And the Georgians are very afraid because of their history, troubled history with Russia. Obviously, they declared independence, but there is, you know, Abkhazia and South Ossetia that are kind of an open wound still, and they did fight a war with the Russians too.
And so, you know, it's the same thing that basically Zelensky is saying in this video. He's characterizing the Russian aggression and pointing out that, you know, the entire region is threatened, and then subsequently the rest of Europe as well.
So, yeah, I mean, this is the way that's one of the big things that people disagree on, right? It's to what extent does threatening Ukraine, Georgia, or even the Baltic republics, certainly Moldova, because of Transnistria, to what extent does this imply any designs on the rest of Europe? And I think there's a bit of a kind of misunderstanding. People talk about, oh, if, you know, Ukraine falls, he's certainly going to invade, you know, further. That's not at all clear, because he doesn't need to be invading anything in order to get a lot more influence in Europe again. So there's, I think, two scenarios, right, with Ukraine. The problem is, if most of Ukraine is conquered, first of all, it's going to be seen portrayed as an outright defeat for the West, because we're seen as having invested heavily in helping Ukraine. And although here people would say, as long as some part of Ukraine remains independent, it's victory for Ukraine, that's not how it's going to play out, right? The Russians, the Chinese, everybody else will see it as basically Russia standing on its own against the combined forces of the West and prevailing in, you know, tearing a piece, a significant chunk of territory from Ukraine. And then it's anybody's guess what happens next, frankly, because in this scenario, you know that Russia will be emboldened at the very least. They will not probably attack immediately. They will anything, because they will need years to reconstruct from the mess they created. I mean, they're in terrible shape, actually, economically and militarily. So they're in no condition to go and attack Poland or, you know, challenge NATO or anything like this. But what's going to happen is they will strengthen their relationship with China. With the war over, the Chinese don't have to worry too much about, you know, running afoul of sanctions and things like this, which means the U.S. will concentrate more and more in the Pacific. And then it's completely up to the Europeans to decide what to do. And I'm quite afraid, frankly, that many Europeans would kind of long to go back to the good old days where they kind of seek some sort of accommodation with Russia instead of participating in what would be Cold War 2.0.
Do you think it emboldens China if the scenario as you lay it out plays out?
Yes. One thing I kind of seems to be the case is that they don't want Russia to fail. Then I'm not sure they actually want Russia to win a whole lot either. They seem to enjoy kind of this Russia being in a subordinate position and kind of draining the resources and distracting the West while China is, you know, trying to establish more and more influence over Taiwan.
But it clearly, I see how you make, it's an interesting point about, it puts China in a better position with Russia, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. And you get to enjoy. See, the problem with war is that it very quickly begins to erode a lot of these benefits that you have, right? Kind of being a great power is being able to fight a war in another great power, but actually fighting a war in another great power usually is a very bad idea and ends pretty badly for everybody involved. And so the best thing from a Chinese perspective is, yes, for their relationship with Russia to strengthen, for the West to be drained. From this, the Western commitment to Taiwan to seem to weaken, and over time, they can get probably peacefully what they're after. The more you can do it peacefully, the less reason there is to invade. I mean, part of the reason that Putin went after Ukraine militarily is because he realized that he has no more levers to get peacefully what he wanted from them. And so it's not clear to me that China has exhausted this or even begun to exhaust this. And so I'm not sure when emboldened, yes, in a sense that anything that's bad for the West is good for China. But in terms of this meaning some kind of military confrontation, I'm not sure.
Thank you so much for the time.
Yes.
Bronislav Sanchev from the University of California, San Diego. Following these other stories from around the world, the death toll in Papua New Guinea continues to rise following a massive landslide. The International Organization for Migration says now more than 670 people have died as emergency responders and traumatized relatives give up hope that any survivors will now be found. A magnitude 6.6 earthquake rattled the Pacific nation of Tonga on Monday. The United States Geological Survey said there was no threat of a tsunami. The quake was centered in a patch of ocean about 198 kilometers north of Tonga's capital, Nuku'alofa. South Africa's main opposition party, Democratic Alliance, on Sunday made its final appeal to South Africans to help it unseat the ruling African National Congress, as it concluded its campaign ahead of elections this week. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, if you ask the U.S. presidential candidates who's the most religious, chances are both would say, I am. VOA senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Pursuti looks at the attitudes and practices of President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump toward matters of faith. God bless the
USA. For some, a Donald Trump rally is like church.
My faith in Jesus is very important, and I know there's a leader, Donald J. Trump, who was already president, who did a great job when he was in office, who's coming back and will reinstate those values.
The former president's comments on religion,
because God is here and God is watching,
resonate with evangelicals and other conservative Christians.
We will protect Christians in our schools, in our military, in our government.
The God, Guns, and Trump, that's probably one of my best-selling shirts and has been for the last 2 or 3 years or so.
But Trump is far from the typical conservative Christian. The former president has been divorced twice. He's being tried on felony charges of falsifying business records, records linked to hush money payments to an adult film star with whom he allegedly had sex. Some analysts say Trump is using the court case to compare himself to Jesus, whom Christians believe died for the world's sins.
Trump has actually borrowed that language lately. We've seen him saying, I'm being indicted for you.
This Bible is the King James Version.
He is not a regular churchgoer, but on his Truth Social platform, promoted a Bible for sale. An Associated Press poll showed 8 out of 10 white evangelical Christians chose Trump in the last presidential election. A Pew Research Center survey this year showed black Protestants preferring Biden. Whether it's a Saturday night or a Sunday, President Joe Biden attends Catholic Mass, typically here in Delaware where he has a house, or in Georgetown if he's in Washington. To that, his supporters can relate.
He went to an all-boys Catholic high school, was fairly serious about his Catholicism. He spoke my language.
Biden and the First Lady met with the Pope at the Vatican in 2021. Pope Francis told Biden, the nation's second Catholic president, he could continue receiving Holy Communion, despite his views on abortion. Biden's abortion stance makes it complicated for some Catholics. In fact, the poll from the last election showed Catholics split 50-50 between Trump and Biden.
Well, the number one thing is the pro-life issue. It's been disgusting watching Joe Biden proclaim himself as a Catholic and not standing for preborn citizens of our nation.
When Biden talks religion, he speaks of inclusion.
A universal message of hope, of joy, of love. Whether you're Christian, whether you're Jewish, Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist, or any other faith, or no faith at all. It speaks to all of us as human beings who are here on this earth primarily to care for one another.
Overall, Biden practices his faith traditionally, while Trump suggests God is present in his life. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
Lithuanian President Gitanas Nausėda claimed victory in a runoff of the country's presidential election on Sunday, following a campaign dominated by security concerns in the European Union and NATO member next door to Russia.
First of all, I would like to thank Lithuanian people for this support, really very significant and very remarkable support. And I think it gives me the opportunity to continue the work and activities I started 5 years ago.
The Baltic nation of 2.8 million people has been a staunch ally of Ukraine since Russia's 2022 invasion. Like other countries in the region, it worries it could be Moscow's next target. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Israeli airstrikes killed at least 35 Palestinians and wounded dozens in an area in Rafah designated for the displaced, Palestinian Health and Civil Emergency Service officials say. The Israeli military said they were attacking a Hamas compound. The two-state solution to the Israel-Palestinian conflict must be kept alive, according to Saudi Arabia's foreign minister.
You know, there is a consensus, I think, among the international community that the only way to ensure the security, not just of the Palestinian people and the rights of the Palestinian people, but also the security of Israel, is through a two-state solution. And we must do whatever we can to keep that solution alive.
Saudi Arabia and Norway hosted a ministerial meeting on a coordinated approach to the recognition of the Palestinian state in Brussels on Sunday. Japan demanded via diplomatic channels in Beijing on Monday that North Korea cancel its planned satellite rocket launch. North Korea notified Japan of its plan to launch a rocket carrying a space satellite toward the Yellow Sea and east of the Luzon Islands between May 27th and June 4th. 12 people were injured when a Qatar Airways plane flying from Doha to Dublin hit turbulence. Dublin Airport said in a statement that the plane landed safely as scheduled. We get more now from Associated Press correspondent Rika Ann Garcia.
Most of the injured were hospitalized. Dublin Airport said in a statement that flight QR017 landed safely as scheduled. Upon landing, the aircraft was met by emergency services, including airport police and the fire and rescue department, to tend to the passengers and crew members. Qatar Airways stated that an internal investigation is underway. Rika Ann Garcia, London.
Experts say that air turbulence could be getting worse because of climate change. We get more on that now from Reuters correspondent Rachel Faber.
We could start feeling that the airplane was entering some kind of turbulence. So the plane starts shaking. It kept getting worse and worse and worse.
While fatalities are extremely rare, turbulence-related aircraft incidents are common. A 2023 report from the University of Reading suggests turbulence could get worse as the climate changes and temperatures rise. Airline Ratings Editor-in-Chief Jeffrey Thomas.
Turbulence is becoming more prevalent as climate changes, and a university's research in the United Kingdom has shown that over the last 40 years, severe turbulence has increased by 55%. Moderate turbulence by 37% and slight turbulence or light turbulence by about 17%.
One of the study's authors, Professor Paul Williams, also stressed more research is needed to understand the impact of climate change on air turbulence. But there is some reassurance for passengers.
The industry's made extraordinary strides through technology, weather radar, sophisticated weather radar, and all sorts of other preventative strategies. Over the last 20 years in particular, aircraft are fitted with far more sophisticated radar called multi-scan. They're also making progress into turbulence detection as well.
Following the Singapore Airlines incident, Thomas also says it's important to always wear a seatbelt.
I think this incident will prompt airlines, whether it's an official mandate or not. But airlines saying we recommend you keep your seatbelt fastened while seated. No recommend. I think throw away the word recommend. This is mandated. You must put your seatbelt on.
Reuters correspondent Rachel Faber. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for being with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform, through our apps on Apple and Google, and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has been clear about our positions in private with our Israeli partners, just as we have articulated them publicly time and again, said Robert Wood, United States Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs.
The United States' commitment to Israel's security is ironclad, and I want to repeat, ironclad. We want to see Hamas defeated, Sinwar and other Hamas leaders brought to justice, and the hostages released. We have been very clear that we oppose Hamas's control of Gaza. At the same time, we also do not support and will not support an Israeli reoccupation of Gaza. And we have long maintained our objection to any large-scale military operation in Rafah that risks mass civilian harm.
According to the United Nations, the situation in Gaza has been described as a catastrophe, a nightmare, and hell on earth. In the past 2 weeks, more than 800,000 people have been displaced from Rafah into other areas of Gaza. Most of the displaced have sought refuge in Khan Yunis and Deir al-Balah, but the situation there is horrendous, with inadequate latrines, water points, drainage, and shelter. It is therefore evident that Israel's preparations to meet the needs for those displaced people are insufficient, said Ambassador Wood.
Israel should take immediate and decisive actions to remedy the situation and ensure the protection of civilians. There must be no delay. Lives depend on it.
If there is a bright spot in this disaster, it's the opening of the maritime corridor. The first shipments of humanitarian assistance have arrived on the shores of Gaza through the multinational humanitarian pier, said Ambassador Wood. When at full operating capacity, the humanitarian maritime corridor can provide assistance for up to 500,000 people in 1 month.
More aid from the United States and other countries continues to arrive in Cyprus, where it will be loaded onto ships for delivery to the pier. But in the effort to mitigate famine, aid by sea is not a substitute for aid provided by land. And so, the United States continues to work to further increase the amount of aid getting into Gaza by land crossings.
As President Biden emphasized yesterday, we need an immediate ceasefire to stop the fighting and bring the hostages home, said Ambassador Wood. Hamas must comply with the Security Council's resolution and release the hostages. That is how to bring the fighting to an end.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.